This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We've devoted several shows to the opioid epidemic raging in Connecticut and across the nation. We've talked to people in recovery. We've learned about some of the programs that exist to treat substance abuse issues. And we'd heard from family members who've lost their loved ones to addiction, but who choose to speak out publicly to break down stigma. Those conversations will continue on this show. What have we been missing? You can email me, lucy@wmpr.org. And coming up, we're going to talk to the producer-director of a new PBS documentary, Understanding the Opioid Epidemic. WMPR will screen that documentary later this month in New Haven. More on that just ahead. First, recent figures from the federal government show addiction has naturally impacted a parent's ability to care for his or her child. Multiple states are seeing increases in the number of kids entering the foster care system. What's the best way to help parents and their children without breaking up homes? You can join the conversation today, 860-275-7266. Email wherewelive@wmpr.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Now we're going to find out about a program run by Connecticut's Department of Children and Families and the Yale Child Study Center. It's to keep kids with their parents when the adults are committed to recovery. First, let's find out more about how addiction is impacting the foster care system nationwide. On the phone with me is Sherry Lockman. She is founder and executive director of Foster America. Sherry, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We've seen statistics from the federal government that, again, the number of children entering the foster care system is growing in recent years. In your organization, Foster America, what are you hearing from states and what are the causes?
What we're hearing is that the problem is much worse than most people think. So actually, child abuse and neglect is quite prevalent in our country. 1 in 8 children in our country, 1 in 8, are abused or neglected by the time they turn 18. And when this happens, our government child welfare system steps in and either provides services to the families to help keep the kids at home or places kids in foster care. What we're also seeing is that the problem is getting worse. So after a decade of decline, with regard to the number of kids going into foster care, over the past 4 years, we've seen a spike in these numbers. In Montana, for example, the number of children in foster care has doubled since 2010. In Georgia, it's increased by 80%, and in West Virginia by 45%. And what we see based on federal data and based on what we're hearing from our child welfare agency partners on the ground is that drug abuse is one of the major reasons for this spike, and in particular, within the past few years, opioids. So in 2016, for example, almost 100,000 kids came into foster care because of parental drug use.
In studio with me is Elizabeth Duryea. She's the Connecticut Department of Children and Families Chief of Staff. Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
We're hearing a little bit about the national statistics on the foster care system. When we look at Connecticut's system, how many children are in the foster care system? And are you tracking, what have you noticed in terms of substance abuse being one of the factors where a child is removed?
Well, substance use is really a very prevalent, you know, phenomenon. And as Sherry mentioned, you know, nationally, we also see this playing out in Connecticut. Given some of the trends that we've seen, again, sort of reflective of these ebbs and flows in terms of the number of kids coming into care, where we started in 2011 with roughly 4,200 kids in care at our low point, in 2013 we were down to around 3,900, but we're now seeing that uptick coming up again, where we're, as of December, we had about 4,200 kids again. And what we're really trying to do is avoid, you know, removing kids. And substance use obviously presents a lot of safety considerations when families are referred to the department. When there is some indication of substance use, we really have to do a lot to screen and assess, you know, what are the services that we can put in place in an effort to keep that family together, because we know, you know, removing kids and putting them in the foster care system should really be a last resort.
Now, coming up, we're going to talk more about a specific program that DCF launched with the help of the Yale Child Study Center with that goal of keeping families together. But before we get to that, I wanted to find out more about how that uptick in numbers, Elizabeth, how is that straining? Is it putting a strain on the system to date? How do you handle that when the numbers are going up?
Well, obviously, with our fiscal constraints for Connecticut as a state, everyone's budget, not just DCF's, but our partner agencies, DEMIS, Department of Social Services, I think we're all feeling the crunch. And where we might want to expand services really becomes a challenge. And we've had to look at ways in which we can be a little bit more innovative. And I think the program we're going to talk about will get into some of that. But how can we get out? How can we do that thinking outside of our box, and who are the new partners we need to engage, and how can we more meaningfully collaborate with existing partners to sustain existing programs that we know are working, but also, you know, potentially add some new programs where we see those emerging?
Sherry Lockman, again, founder and executive director of Foster America. You mentioned some of the states where an uptick in the foster care system related to the opioid crisis. How is that putting? How are states handling that that strain on their resources? What's happening to these kids?
Well, state child welfare systems are completely overwhelmed. So what you're actually seeing on the ground is, for example, kids sleeping in their social workers' offices because there aren't enough foster homes available to take in this influx of kids. You see kids being shipped off to prison-like group homes and residential treatment facilities, which are essentially like modern-day orphanages because there are not enough families to take them in. And what we know from both research and from common sense is that the gray walls of institutions are not healthy environments in which to raise children. That's not where they get the unconditional love to develop into healthy adults. So essentially what we're seeing is a perfect storm. Just as the number of kids coming into foster care is dramatically rising, partly as a result of the opioid crisis, at the same time, we see, based on new research from the Chronicle of Social Change, that in at least half the states, the number of foster homes over the past few years, including in Connecticut, has been decreasing.
This is where we live today. We're talking about how substance abuse in the nation, including the opioid epidemic, is impacting the foster care system. On the phone with me again, Sherry Lockman from Foster America. In studio with me, Elizabeth Duryea. She's chief of staff with the Connecticut Department of Children and Families. If you have a family member struggling with addiction, or if you have had experience with the child welfare system in Connecticut, you know, what are some ways that your family has been helped, or ways you'd like to see them helped? You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Now, Sherry, we know there's a lot of attention in recent years to the opioid epidemic. It's not the first drug crisis this country has faced. When we look back to what happened in the 80s with the crack epidemic, and any lessons that we can learn from that, and what was the impact on children then and now?
That comparison is really important. So back in the 70s, 80s, and early 90s, the crack cocaine epidemic tore through communities, including many African American communities. And the reaction to that epidemic was, unfortunately, and I think partly because of racism, it was far less compassionate than the reaction now to the opioid crisis. And what that meant is that instead of treating parents as if they had a health issue with substance use back in that crisis, parents were criminalized, and thousands of children were ripped out of their homes. And because that was the response, our country failed to build the extensive infrastructure needed to help families and their children when their parents are facing substance use issues. And as a result of that, we don't have the infrastructure today to help families who are facing different types of substance use issues, such as opioids. Now, there are some bright spots across the country, and there are unsung heroes in programs like family-based recovery, which I know you'll be featuring later on in the show today. But those bright spots are unfortunately isolated. Those bright spots show that it is possible to help parents overcome substance use challenges and to keep kids and families together, to reunite kids with families in those extremely challenging circumstances. But because we as a country have not prioritized these kids and families and have not fully understood the extent to which substance use is a health problem that should be treated like other health problems, we don't have enough of these programs. We haven't brought programs like family-based recovery to scale in order to respond in the most effective way to each substance use epidemic facing our country.
I mentioned at the top of the show the president had declared the opioid epidemic a public health emergency. Politico reports that that declaration actually runs out in another week, and there was no additional funding attached to that declaration while it drew attention to the problem. I'm curious, because you come from a national perspective, Sherry, with Foster America, what's some legislation that could help from the federal government that could actually go back into the foster care system in many of these states?
So it's one thing to declare an emergency. It's another thing to put your money where your mouth is and actually do something about it. So I think empty rhetoric is not enough. That's not what these kids and families need. In terms of productive policy solutions, there are plenty of them. So, for example, there's a bill called the Family First Act, which would have allowed states to use federal child welfare money not only for kids in foster care, but also to prevent kids from coming into foster care in the first place by providing prevention services such as substance use treatment to their parents in cases where the result of parents dealing with substance use issues was that it was making it difficult for them to care for their kids. In addition, we have to be careful to do no harm. I am particularly worried about the rhetoric in D.C. right now around potential cuts to Medicaid. If Medicaid were to get cut, that would mean many more families would not have the health insurance that they need to seek treatment when they're facing substance use challenges. We saw in the past few days that the Trump administration announced that they're going to allow states to apply to deny Medicaid to parents who are not working. And as New York Times editorial board pointed out, that reasoning is backwards because many parents need to get the insurance they need to get substance use treatment in order to then go back to work.
I wanted to get the take of Elizabeth Duryea again because she works for the State Department of Children and Families here in Connecticut. Sherry mentioned this Families First Act. You know, what are some other avenues where the federal government could be helping states like Connecticut deal with an uptick or just keeping kids out of the foster care system to begin with?
I really appreciate Sherry's perspective nationally, and I think it's important because it is something that we're seeing consistently throughout, you know, all the states. And the need for federal finance reform and shining a light on this issue in a way that, you know, helps to dispel the stigma that attaches to these families. And when you think about the fact that you have someone who is combating a substance use disorder, and they're a parent, and more often than not, they want to be a good parent. And at times, you know, government agencies do not set them up with the supports and services they need to do just that. And that is a really powerful motivator, I know, behind family-based recovery and a lot of other in-home interventions. But back to the finance reform piece, you can't use federal funding in a way to incentivize removing kids and putting them in foster care. And the issue of federal finance reform has really been something that we've been watching very closely, as has every other state, because it is a source of revenue that we are very reliant on. And it is Medicaid, it is 4E funding, you know, there's McVie dollars, there are TANF dollars. These are all the federal funding streams that we know fuel human services. And when we in Connecticut continue to experience fiscal constraints, those are, you know, funding streams that we're really very heavily reliant on. And to be able to use those flexibly
to fund prevention. And I say fund prevention, meaning, you know, how can we prevent removals by providing, you know, supports and services to families that really does, you know, break that connection to incentivizing placements in foster care.
I wanted to go back to Sherry Lockman before we head to break again, founder and executive director of Foster America. We're talking about how substance abuse is impacting the foster care system nationwide. When we look at the opioid crisis in recent years, Sherry, is this problem growing at such a rate that you're not able to see public funding streams match to try to solve these issues?
That is a solvable problem. This is a national crisis, and the funding does not match the level of need by any means. But we can do better. We do see states like Connecticut actually addressing this challenge, not just with funding, but also with smart policy and smart administrative action. So, for example, Dave Wilkinson, who leads the Office of Early Childhood, and Joette, who leads the Department of Children and Families, have been collaborating together to figure out how do you work across sectors in order to identify kids and families at risk earlier on from a number of challenges, including substance use, and then collaborate in order to give those families the services they need and keep kids out of the foster care system when possible in the first place.
I want to thank Sherry Lockman, founder and executive director of Foster America. Again, it's a nonprofit focused on improving the child welfare system. Sherry, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. In studio with me, Elizabeth Duryea, Chief of Staff for the Connecticut Department of Children and Families. Coming up, we're going to talk more about the family-based recovery program created by DCF and partners at the Yale Child Studies Center and Johns Hopkins. Do you have experience with the Connecticut's child welfare system? What kind of programs are needed to help parents with addiction issues? Join the conversation. We'll take your calls after the break. 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today, we wanted to talk about a family-based treatment program created by the Connecticut Department of Children and Families and Yale's Child Study Center. The idea is to help parents who have substance abuse issues while keeping the family intact. We're talking about this today because federal figures show that many states are seeing a rise in the number of children entering the foster care system because of substance abuse issues in the home. Before we learn more about the family-based recovery program and plans to expand it, I wanted to take a listener phone call. Joe's calling from South Windsor. Joe, go ahead with your question or comment.
Sure. I took in my first two foster children through Casey Family Services in 1985. They were siblings born to a drug-addicted mom, and I've watched through two generations now how the system has failed not only those two children, but the children born to them. I watched each of those two children lose two children into the system, and I adopted two of them to keep them out of the system. And the fundamental problem that I see with our foster care system is that supports disappear when the child ages out at age 18. And that's when the child is most susceptible to become drug addicted himself or herself. But they, because they've been through what they've been through, are not going to be mature individuals until they're sometime in their 30s. And that gap of services from the time they age out at 18 until they grow up sometime around 30 is when they give birth to a couple of more children in their own drug addiction. And then the state rushes in to grab those children, threatening the parents with charges of neglect and abuse that all go away if they sign their children away. And nobody deals with their own drug addiction. And that's been my frustration for two generations. And I'll listen to your comments off the air.
Well, thank you, Joe, for your call. Elizabeth Duryea is in studio with us again. She's chief of staff for the Department of Children and Families. I mean, how do you respond to Joe's concerns about how there is a gap? And we'll learn more about, again, there is a strategy that's been in place for several years to try to not have the children even enter the foster care system to begin with. But sometimes that happens. So there's some consequences to that chain of events. Can we talk about some of Joe's concerns, Elizabeth?
Absolutely. And I appreciate his call. And unfortunately, the complaints and the issues that he's raised are all too frequent and do reflect, you know, why the system needs to rethink the way in which we're engaging families and what are we doing to invest in services that will help avert kids growing up in foster care, aging out, you know, with few supports. And a lot of that is about money. And I know we've touched on that briefly this morning and where we can, you know, get those federal funding supports in. You know, it's not all about money, though. It is really about how are we effectively engaging families and meeting them where they're at and supporting our foster parents and putting in place those supports that we know they need. And given the uptick we're seeing of kids coming into care, we need more foster families. And that number sort of calibrates as we see, you know, more referrals coming into the department, you know, where there's the opioid crisis or other contributing factors. But that the recruitment of foster families is a constant, you know, need that we have. I also think that the department has really done a lot to invest in services that allow for us to keep kids with their families, provide those wraparound supports in an effort to avert that trajectory, which we see in Connecticut, we also see nationally, where this, there becomes this multi-generational involvement with child welfare. But, you know, it's not just about child welfare. It's really about the human service system as a whole. And we see, you know, correlation to housing instability and unemployment and, you know, substance use and other behavioral health disorders, and that it really does require a holistic approach across, you know, many different agencies and many different sectors. And that's where I'm hopeful, as Sherry mentioned in her comments, where there are some bright spots that we can, in spite of our fiscal constraints, think, you know, in different ways to engage families. And I think that the success or what we're excited about with family-based recovery in this expansion is we've had to engage some unconventional partners like philanthropy. And how can we get philanthropy to push government to think outside, you know, what has just been, you know, sort of funding the same old services year in and year out. And we have a lot more work to do there. So I appreciate Joe's calls and the issues that we need to be attentive to.
Let's find out about one of these holistic programs, right? Mm-hmm. So not just focusing on taking breaking up a family because they may be struggling with addiction. Since 2006, there's been a program. It's called Family-Based Recovery. I wanted to find out more about it. In studio with us now, Karen Hansen, director of the Family-Based Recovery Services Program at the Yale Child Study Center. Karen, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good morning. Thank you for letting us talk about this innovative program.
So it's been around, again, since 2006. This is a program you helped develop mm-hmm. with DCF. Can you describe, you know, what was the catalyst? Why were you thinking about this particular way of helping families?
Actually, DCF was the catalyst for the development of the model. They were recognizing that in the early 2000s, there was an uptick in children being placed in foster care and really trying to determine what was the reason those children were being placed. And one of the things, the common factors was parental substance use. And so the department approached Johns Hopkins University that had an evidence-based substance use treatment program, reinforcement-based therapy, and the Child Study Center, which had an in-home treatment program for parents who use substances and young children. And the three parties came together. And within 7 months, we developed family-based recovery and launched it at the Yale Child Study Center. And then it's since been replicated across the state with 16 other teams doing the model. And what makes us innovative is we're taking substance use treatment and individual psychotherapy into the home, into the family's home, to break down barriers. A lot of families don't have transportation or childcare that allows them to access traditional resources. In addition to the substance use treatment, we're providing infant mental health care to the parent and to the parent-child dyad. And we're working with families with children 0 to 3. And so when the caller talked about how he had seen this happen in 2 generations, my hope would be that in now, because we've had the expansion of FBR across every city in the state, that families like his would have access to the services to prevent the children from being removed from the home and to actually work with the parent. One of the things that we have found so unique about this program is that we treat not men and women, we treat moms and dads. And the opportunity to parent that baby, that infant, that young child is a huge motivator for change.
Can I just interject, you know, some people might be listening and thinking, you know, if somebody's using drugs, is it a good idea to keep that child in the home? How do you decide who is the right candidate for this?
Well, actually, all of our referrals come from the Department of Children and Families. We work in a partnership and a collaboration. And certainly, safety of the child is paramount for all of us. But we also recognize that attachment is critical for healthy development. And removing a child is not necessarily always in their best interest. Each parent who uses substances needs to be thought of as a unique family unit. And we need to assess for safety and risk constantly. We put safety plans in place so that the parent is not actively using when they're parenting that child, that they get a sober caregiver in place. We're always looking out for what's in the child's best interest. But we recognize that not every substance use episode is the same. And if the parent makes appropriate, healthy choices for their children, that the opportunity for that child to form a secure attachment with that parent is part of the process. And the first 18 months of your life is critical for setting up future success. And so we really don't want to have that rupture if we can prevent it. And I have to tell you how many parents have said to us, if my child was removed, I probably would continue using. But because I have this child now, and because I'm a mom, my child deserves better for me. And I'm going to stop using because I have this child.
Elizabeth Duryea, Chief of Staff for Connecticut's DCF. We know that recovery is a lifelong process. So you have maybe a parent or parents involved with the family-based recovery program. What happens when they relapse?
Well, obviously, there is a lot of dependency on the individual case. And I think Karen hit on a really important point that it is our duty to meet each family that we are working with wherever they're at in their recovery process. And we recognize that recovery is a lifelong process and that relapse, you know, unfortunately, is a fairly, you know, natural part of that journey. And so what we opt to do and through family-based recovery and even our own work with the families is the relapse should not be an automatic trigger, again, for removal, for filing a court petition, but really trying to figure out, you know, is there a safety concern present that can be mitigated with services, with supports that will allow for us, again, to avoid that knee-jerk reaction that we've often seen. And Karen mentioned when, you know, family-based recovery was first implemented in 2006, that was really at a high point or that far pendulum swing where we were seeing, you know, a lot of kids in care. There were over 7,000 kids in care. We're now around 4,200. And we at the department, and I know with our partners both at Yale Child Study and throughout the state have really tried to, you know, build a more robust array of in-home services that allow for us to avoid that traditional knee-jerk reaction we often have historically seen in child welfare to remove kids.
Someone with some on-the-ground experience in this family-based recovery services program we're talking about today on Where We Live is Heidi Veltheim. She's a senior clinician with the program. She's on the phone. Heidi, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you. Good morning.
We were hearing Karen mention how it's very, very important to be able to provide these services to families in their home. You've been doing this for 5 years now. Tell us about what the work you're doing.
So, yes, it's a very innovative program where we are able to literally and figuratively meet the clients where they are. Being able to bring this treatment to their home is an amazing experience for them and for us as the staff of the programs. And it's just, you know, it's great to be able to see some of the progress that we are able to see with the families. We're with them for anywhere from 6 to 9 months, sometimes even a little longer than 9 months. So we really get to see a lot of struggles and a lot of successes in that time.
I had the question about what happens when an individual might relapse. Does that, Elizabeth had mentioned it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to remove the child from the home at that particular point. I mean, how do you work with that with your clients? Because we know that it is difficult to be in recovery, and it is a lifelong process.
Sure, right. And we recognize that relapse is part of some people's recovery journey, not everyone, but some people. So if there is a disclosed relapse or we find out about a relapse through the urine screen, we do our best to really find out where the child was, were they safe, work with the parent on what was going on for them, any internal triggers, any external triggers. And we ask those questions, first of all, as Karen said, we're constantly assessing for safety and risk in the home, but also to hopefully create a plan with the client so that if relapse, hopefully relapse doesn't happen again, but if it does, how can everyone be safe during that time? We will even in the moment ask the client, we have to notify DCF if there's been a relapse. Or if there's a positive urine screen. And so we offer to do that with the client in the home for not only for support for the client, but also to, potentially answer any questions that the DCF worker might have about the conditions or the circumstances around the relapse.
Karen Hansen, again, is with Yale Child Studies Center. She's in studio with me. This program has been around now for about 10 years. How do you measure success? How does, when you look at this treatment option versus others that are out there?
So we measure success on a variety of different areas. We look at where the placement of the index child is at discharge. And we have treated over 1,400 families in the state of Connecticut since we started this service. And 81% of those children are living with a biological parent at the time of discharge. We also look at parents, Heidi mentioned, toxicology screens. We do toxicology screens at each visit. And we look at the course of treatment and the toxicology screens. And we've seen that clients start with 50% of them have a positive toxicology screen at intake. It's down to 15% at the week 20, which we also measure as a positive success. Mm-hmm. We're also interested in parental well-being because it's not a lot of our clients can say, I can stop using, but then I am left with trying to figure out how to live life in recovery. Mm-hmm. And many of them come with comorbid mental health issues, trauma histories, and so they really need to be able to deal with the psychological issues. So we measure parental depression, and we see statistically significant changes pre-post for parental depression. And we also look at parental stress, and we see the same statistically significant changes and decrease in stress for those parents. I think one of the exciting opportunities that we have right now that the department has set us up with other partners and the philanthropic partners that we have and social finance out of Boston is the Pay for Success Project, which is allowing us to do a randomized control trial mm-hmm. so that we can compare FBR to treatment in the community. Because in the past, there's only been 12 slots per team. And so families were randomized into FBR or not. It just wasn't sort of an established protocol. And now we're going to get a lot more data to see how effective we are. But our internal data suggests that parents are doing better, they're feeling better, and their children are remaining with them, and they're not using substances.
This is Where We Live. Today we're looking at some programs that try to keep the family together despite substance abuse. We're learning about a family-based recovery services program that DCF and Yale Child Studies Centers have been doing for more than a decade now. And I understand, Elizabeth Duryea, with DCF, there's now an expansion to this related to what we've been talking about is the opioid epidemic.
Yeah, it is an exciting project to talk about, and I think at its core, we call it the Family Stability Project, which is a public-private partnership that has allowed for us to work with family-based recovery and expand that model to serve more families. So over the course of the Family Stability Project, we will be serving an additional 500 families throughout the state. I should say in specific areas of the state where our data reflected that we had unmet need relative to parent and caregiver substance use. And so the data on our end really informed, if we have this opportunity that in spite of our budget crisis on the state level, this pay-for-success finance tool gave us an exciting sort of grant-like opportunity to draw in some funding from outside of government
that we wouldn't otherwise have. And it also allowed for us to do that by engaging some unconventional as well as, you know, traditional partners. We've got a great network of nonprofit providers throughout the state, and we really have one of the most comprehensive service arrays of any child welfare system around the country. But getting philanthropy, getting the universities involved, you know, these are people who are grounded in research and can really help to inform what are the services that we need to see more of? What is the research telling us? And FBR is very grounded in all of what best practice is and really pushing child welfare agencies to think beyond what has been that traditional child welfare response where we're removing kids, we're putting them in foster care. And
this adversarial relationship.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And giving us a tool to engage families, as you've heard all of us saying, meet them where they're at, you know, do it in a meaningful, collaborative way, but also pulling in these unconventional partners. And of course, philanthropy joining through investing in this was a huge incentive because these are funds we wouldn't otherwise have to support this expansion.
We just have a couple more minutes. I wanted to fit in a call from a listener. Tammy's calling from Bristol. Tammy, go ahead. We just have a couple of minutes. Go ahead with
okay.
your question or comment.
All right. Well, I just want to make a couple of comments. The opioid epidemic that you're talking about affects me because I'm on the opposite side of that coin. I need it daily for chronic pain, and I have an issue that will never go away. It's forever. And so I'm having a hard time getting my medication because of that. That's not fair to people like me. And I get it that there are addicts out there. The man I'm in love with is an addict on crack. And there's nothing I can do, and I feel helpless. And the second one is that with DCF, DCF rips families apart. They don't try to keep them together. I'm living proof. My daughter is 25. I have two. My youngest is 25, a paralegal. Works for the city of Bristol, chose that direction because of what DCF did to our family. And she and I are both going to be going to the Capitol, and I already have a bill in place. I just got to get it passed so that the statute of limitations that are now up, I can get them erased and pursue legally what needs to be done.
Well, Tammy, I just wanted to let Elizabeth Duryea from DCF respond to your comments, because, again, we were talking just before about this longstanding adversarial feeling in the community from some when they have child welfare involved in their families and how you address that.
Well, Tammy, I am sorry to hear about your experience, and I also recognize that, as Lucy mentioned, there's really no one who is going to want DCF in their home, and the department is conscious of that. And while I'm not familiar with the specifics of individual cases, I can certainly speak to the fact that the way in which we're trying to reframe how we engage families in the communities and focus on keeping families together, because families are a strength for the children who come to our attention. And they are a resource that we know we need to support. And that is the direction of child welfare, not just in Connecticut, but also, as Sherry touched on earlier in today's program, where we see this going nationally. And I think family-based recovery is one tool in our toolbox to do a better job.
You mentioned the Family Stability Program, this new program being launched. Specific areas in the state, and when will it be on the ground?
The new services have launched. They've launched in three areas of the state where we've seen a particular demonstrated need, which we are correlating to, you know, you can look at the opioid deaths.
So Litchfield County, for one?
It's three of DCF's six regions, the northwest corner of the state, so Danbury, Waterbury, Torrington, the pretty much the whole entire eastern half of the state, which we know is very rural. Both of those areas are very rural. We also know that we don't necessarily have a lot of providers in those areas of the state. So this is an important support to our providers as well, where we're able to bring in new resources to support, you know, their programs. And then the third area where we've scaled up is actually in New Haven. And what we haven't really touched on is through the Family Stability Project, we're working with Karen and others at Yale Child Study to expand the model. So Karen's, the family-based recovery has traditionally served families with kids 0 to 3. And now through this family stability launch of services that began in 2016 and is now up and running, were able to serve families with kids up to age 6.
So we'll have to have you back to find out how that's going down in New Haven. But we do appreciate your time, and we have to leave it there, unfortunately. I want to thank Elizabeth Duryea, Department of Children and Families Chief of Staff, and Karen Hansen, Director of the Family-Based Recovery Services Program at Yale Child Study Center, also Senior Clinician with that program, Heidi Veltheim. Thank you all for coming in.
Thank you
very much.
Coming up, a new PBS documentary explores the opioid epidemic in the U.S. We're going to talk to the producer and writer after the break, and you can join the conversation too. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. The story behind the opioid epidemic is being told in a new PBS documentary. Join me Tuesday, January 23rd at Gateway Community College in New Haven for the screening of Understanding the Opioid Epidemic, followed by a panel discussion. More information at WMPR.org. Now, the producer-writer of that documentary joins us now by phone. John Grant, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
The attention on the opioid overdose crisis specifically has been going on now for a few years, John. What did you focus in on with this documentary?
I think our primary focus was on the what I call the unintended consequences of opioid drug use, which is the people who become addicted through prescription painkillers, people who go to the doctor for a knee injury or a back injury or sometimes it's chronic pain that they've lived with all their lives. Or a young person goes to the dentist and gets their wisdom teeth pulled, and the dentist gives them 30 Oxycontin when a couple of good, strong, extra-strength Excedrin might do the trick. So we really focused on the role that prescription painkillers played in creating a large portion of the devastation caused by opioid abuse.
You focus in on the pharmaceutical companies, also how perceptions and expectations changed in the medical community as this crisis became more known. Something very specific in your documentary that I want to pull out of it is you feature an actual television ad from Purdue. This is a pharmaceutical company headquartered here in Stamford, Connecticut. I want to play that clip.
Some patients may be afraid of taking opioids because they're perceived as too strong or addictive. But that is far from actual fact.
In your research, John, what did you uncover in what you talk about in this documentary is how these things were marketed to doctors around the country?
I guess in the harshest terms, I would say I discovered that sometimes companies do things for the purpose of profits that are not in the public good. And occasionally, they actually go a step further and knowingly market products that they know are being used for purposes that they weren't intended for. And I think that's what happened here. You know, there are far more opioids produced in this country now and over the past 25 years than could possibly be used to deal with pain in patients. There's enough opioids produced so that every American in this country right now could have a bottle, a 30-day supply of opioids. Mm. And nobody needs a 30-day supply unless you're in the hospital for surgery or having chronic pain. And I need to hear one of your callers talk about her issue of chronic pain, and she can't function without painkillers. And that's kind of an interesting subset of this topic, because there are a lot of people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s who have always been using opioids. And those just need, they need to continue doing that through their doctor. And there are ways, to be able to do that and not become, quote, a drug addict from it. But that's really a subset of what happens. And those people are a little afraid of all this talk about opioids and restricting opioid use because they have to jump through more hoops, frankly, now to get a doctor to give them a prescription. You have to go in and give a urine sample often before you can do it to prove that you're not on other drugs and that sort of thing. So those are some of the unintended consequences.
You focus on the role of pharmaceutical companies. You talk with the doctors about the changing views, again, of how to prescribe these medications when they know their patients are in pain, and that's their job is to try to relieve that pain for them. But you also focus in on the role of health insurance companies. Talk us through that, John.
I think health insurance companies maybe have the most complicated relationship with the opioid epidemic, with physicians and pharmaceuticals, it's a much sort of clearer picture of what happened and what went wrong. Insurance companies face the drug epidemic at the beginning because they're paying frequently or often for patients to get these opioids. And then when they become addicted, they're paying for the treatment on the back end of that as well. The challenge, I think, is that insurance companies track information on all the doctors they deal with, and they track it very well. They know who the overprescribing doctors are, and they've known it for decades, but they do very little about it. And I think that's where they could be much more aggressive. And like the company that we featured in the program, you know, they do send letters out to what they call their one top 1% of overprescribers. But the letters simply say, hey, we know you're prescribing too many, cut it out. It doesn't cut the doctor off. It doesn't threaten to cut the doctor off. And they use the reasoning that they really don't want to get between a doctor and the patient in that relationship. But as we all know, insurance companies get between doctors and patients all the time in what they approve and don't approve to be covered by insurance. So I think the insurance companies could be, you know, more aggressive. They're caught in a way in this opioid epidemic, like many people, but they could do more, I think, to cut down on the overprescribers.
I should mention that your documentary does a really, it's a very painful to watch, listening to these family stories, because that's really at the root of this problem, is it's impacting people. You interview a couple of families, including the family of Cameron Weiss. Tell us about him and how he became addicted.
Well, Cameron attended the best high school academically, financially, you know, in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He was a good athlete, a good student. He injured his shoulder wrestling and needed surgery to repair his dislocated shoulder. Was prescribed opioids, OxyContin, and then a few months later hurt his shoulder playing football, the other shoulder. He didn't dislocate it, but it was injured, didn't require surgery, and he was given opioids again, and he became addicted. He liked them. And his addiction then led him to go to heroin, because street opioids are very expensive. Albuquerque happens to be at a very interesting crossroads, in, literally, physically, geographically, at a crossroads of the American heroin epidemic. And so heroin is cheap in Albuquerque. So he went from his very affluent, upscale neighborhood, you know, down the road about 10 miles, and started buying heroin, and he got a bad batch of heroin, overdosed, and killed himself. I think he was 19 or 20 years old.
John, did you find, after speaking to his family with school officials in your research, that there is a tension on how to keep high school athletes from getting addicted when they are injured?
I found very little of that, very little knowledge of the problem, very little awareness. High schools don't often even have trainers with their athletic teams. And so when an athlete gets hurt, they tend to go to their family doctor, and the family doctor treats them for whatever it is. And there's not really a lot of tracking that goes on. You know, the coach isn't saying, hey, what did he prescribe? Or, you know, all the coach knows is you dislocated your shoulder, you're out for the season, pretty much. So there isn't a lot of monitoring that goes on, I think. And a lot of people then point to the family. And I'll be honest with you, when I started down this road and interviewed the first mother and father who I interviewed who had lost their son, you know, I walked out of the pre-interview and thought, you know, that wouldn't happen in my family. I would have caught that. You know, these must be bad parents I was talking to. And then I found out they weren't bad parents. They were excellent parents, and that other parents were caught in the same thing. And their son happened to be being treated for a lifetime, intestinal image problem that he had that was very painful. And he suddenly got addicted to his painkillers. The doctors were over-prescribing, and they trusted their doctors. And so I felt very bad from that point on that I thought I misjudged those parents. And I think that's very easy for us to do sometimes, is say, that wouldn't happen in my family. I would have stopped it. And I've met so many parents who are good parents, loving parents, who simply didn't see it coming.
John Grant is producer and writer of Understanding the Opioid Epidemic. It's a new PBS documentary. It'll be airing on CPTV. We're going to tweet out information on where you can see it. Also, we hope you can join me on Tuesday, January 23rd at Gateway Community College in New Haven. We're going to screen that documentary and have a panel discussion with the community. John, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it today.
Okay, thank you very much.
Our show today was produced by Carmen Baskoff. Our technical producer is Kion Wolf. Special thanks to Lydia Brown. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. As always, thanks for listening.